want me to record.
So, these lectures are actually videotapes.
For this lecture, every lecture. Wow.
If you want, you can put it in there. You can put the recorder in here if you want, but the lectures are taped. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
All right, so let's start. I guess today we're switching gears in some way. Up until now, we've been mostly talking about classification methods or regression methods. So both of those are discriminative methods, and the goal is to try to predict something similar. From now, for a few lectures going forwards, we'll look at unsupervised methods. So today, I'll briefly talk about clustering methods in general, what different types of clustering methods they are, and how you can sort of classify them. And then we'll look in detail at k-means clustering algorithm, which is perhaps one of the simplest clustering algorithms out there. I'll talk about the practical issues that you need to resolve when you do k-means, and we'll also talk about one application of k-means clustering. And this is it's not an intrinsic application. It's not an application where clustering is sort of used in and of itself. This is an example of how k-means clustering is actually used as a pre-processing step for another machine learning task. So you use clustering to transform your data into some form and then feed that form into a classifier. So that's the example. If you're trying to follow the textbook, the k-means, this is section 4.8 and 6.6 of the textbook. Okay. So the basic idea behind clustering is you are, it's not a supervised task. You're not trying to predict something specific. You're not trying to predict ham or spam or an age of a particular item. The goal of clustering is you have some population of instances, individuals, and you're trying to figure out what is the structure of that population. So that is, it's a vague task because you usually don't know what the structure is when you start with. When you're just looking at a population, you want to discover something about it. That's the general property of unsupervised methods. And clustering specifically tries to answer questions about the subpopulations of your main population. So if you imagine you have a big set of individuals or items, you might ask questions, well, what are the subpopulations in this set? Can I break it down further, right? And as soon as you ask that question, all sorts of additional questions pop up. So for example, if I can break it down further, how many subpopulations are there? So what is the right number What is the right number of clusters? What are their sizes? Do you expect the sizes of the subpopulation to follow a certain pattern? Once you look at a subpopulation, suppose you broke your population into certain subsets, is there, for a particular subset, is there some property that is common for all the elements in that subpopulation? So for example, is it the case that one of your subpopulations is all female? Is that something that you can say? Another question is, okay, you've broken it down. Can you break it down further? So this gets into questions of looking at trees and ontologies rather than a flat partition of the data. So finally, one thing that is useful, that clustering can be used for, is to identify outliers. So those are either points that don't seem to fit into any cluster particularly well, or perhaps there is something else that's interesting about the clusters and the way points get grouped into them. So clustering can be used for sort of detection of odd instances in the data. So there are many different clustering methods. We're only going to cover a small sampling, but it's useful to sort of try to characterize the clustering methods in some way. And here are just three possible characteristics that you could look at. So the first one is monothetic versus polythetic. So a monothetic clustering is a clustering such that all the elements in the cluster have some identifiable property. So you can, another way to say this is, if you have a monothetic clustering, you look at a cluster and you can say why all the elements are in this cluster, and the things that are not in it, you can say why they're not in it. Now, it turns out that monothetic clustering methods are actually quite rare, and we're not going to look at any of them in this course. The closest thing that we've seen is when we talked about nearest neighbors, we talked about KD trees. So that's, if you remember, that's a data structure that you can use in low dimensions to speed up the search for nearest neighbors. And the way it works, it slices up the space based on sort of one attribute at a time at a median. So a KD tree is an example. You can think of it as a clustering algorithm, because what you end up with in the end are a set of clusters. And it is monothetic in the sense that if you look at the if you look at each element, you can actually, there is a small number of decisions that went into putting that entry into that particular cluster. It's not just one property; it's usually a handful. So the main advantage of monothetic clusterings are they're interpretable. So if you do have a method like that, then you can explain to the end user why these items got grouped together. So it's something explainable. All of the methods that we're going to look at are polythetic, in the sense that there isn't a single property that explains why things went into this cluster. Instead, what defines cluster membership is distance between instances. So we have attribute value representations for our items, and in all of these clustering methods, we're going to be computing distances either between the instances themselves and then putting them together based on this distance, or distance between items and some sort of a cluster representative, a cluster center in a way. So that's specifically what k-means does. So if you have a polythetic clustering, you cannot really put a finger on what makes this element a member of this particular cluster, except to say that it's close to the center of this cluster, or it's close to other members that are within this cluster. And that's not much of an explanation if you have to explain something to the end user. So that's a difference. Okay, another way to classify another way to categorize clustering methods is by how they treat overlap. So hard clustering methods don't allow any overlap between the clusters. So you are taking a population and you are partitioning it in such a way that any individual, it falls into one subpopulation or the other, but it cannot fall into two of them. So that's a hard boundary. Soft clustering is, and we'll do this in the next lecture. Soft clustering has the property that elements can actually be in multiple clusters at the same time. And but what you'll have is you'll have a measure of association or a probability that this element falls into the first cluster or the second cluster or the third cluster. So the big difference is, in one case, it's a clean partition. You either go here or here. In the soft clustering case, typically every instance, every element is a member of every cluster, just with different confidence, just with a different weight. Okay. Another useful way to categorize clustering methods is by what they produce. So what we'll talk about today is k-means. It's a flat clustering method. A flat clustering method takes your population and breaks it down into a set of groups. So for example, if you had animals, you could have, you know, as a result of clustering, you could have, you know, maybe you grouped all the parrots together and all the penguins together and all the sharks together, whales and whatever, dogs, right? So that is a flat partitioning of the data. A hierarchical partitioning would actually say, look, not only am I breaking them down into these groups, but the groups themselves, they have a bit of a structure to them as well. So the parrots and penguins, they're both part of this meta cluster of birds, and the shark, and I guess the whales and the dogs are part of the mammals cluster, if your clustering method can produce something like that. And we will talk about a method that produces hierarchies a few lectures down the line. Okay. So the methods that we'll cover in this course. This lecture is about k-means. K-means is a polythetic method, as are all the methods that we'll cover in the course. It has hard boundaries, so an element is either in one cluster or in the other, but it can't be in both. And k-means produces flat clusterings. We'll talk about an extension to k-means that allows you to do it hierarchically, but sort of out of the box, it is a flat clustering method. The basic thing that k-means does is, given a population, you specify how many subpopulations there should be, and it will find the subpopulations for you. As you sort of think about it, there's this big if. You have to know actually how many subpopulations there are, but it turns out that's not really the biggest problem with k-means. There are ways that you can sort of sweep for the optimal number of clusters, and we'll talk about that later. But it turns out that there are sort of other things that make k-means a strange method. So that's this lecture. In the next lecture, we're going to talk about the EM algorithm and how it can be used to fit a mixture of Gaussians to the data. So this is actually very closely related to k-means, even though the mathematics looks a lot different. They're very similar. The only difference is in how they treat the boundaries. K-means is a hard boundary method, and a Gaussian mixture is soft boundaries, right? So an element will actually belong to every component of the Gaussian mixture, just with a different probability. And then the next thing we'll talk about agglomerative clustering. So that is a method that, starting with a set of instances, combines them sort of from the bottom up in such a way that it produces a tree or a hierarchy, or you can think of it as sort of an automatically produced ontology of sorts. Agglomerative clustering, it also has hard boundaries. There are versions that produce soft boundaries, probabilistic hierarchical methods. We will not be covering them. All right, so let's look at k-means in detail. So as I said, it's a hard clustering method, and it produces a fixed, a flat set of clusters. So in order to run k-means, you need to specify k. K is the number of subpopulations that you want k-means to find. And a basic assumption about k-means is what it will try to do is it will try to create a representative, sort of a vector that serves as a center for each one of these subpopulations, these clusters. And what it'll do is it'll try to move these centers around in such a way that each center sits in the middle of a group of sort of, of instances that are all similar to each other and similar to that center. Now, so that's a high level intuition, but we'll go through an example of what it does. Now, so how can you use this? This doesn't necessarily seem very useful right off the bat, especially since you need to specify k. So you can use this method in a number of ways. So it's sometimes useful in and of itself if you've got a population and you want to sort of look at what the groupings are. You can also use it, so you can sometimes use it in fairly strange ways. So you could try, if you had handwritten digits, but you didn't have any labeled examples, you could actually try clustering things, right? So you know there are only 10 digits, so supposedly there are 10 subpopulations, one for digit 0, one for digit 1, and all the way up to digit 9. So you could try to run k-means clustering over digits, and in this way sort of discover the classes without any labeled data. Now, this might sound too good to be true, and it actually is too good to be true. So if you do it, if your data is very nice and clean, sometimes you get reasonable results. Most of the time, you don't actually get you don't get clusters that correspond to digits. But you can use k-means clustering in lots of other ways as a precursor to doing other methods. So it can be used as a pre-processing step for classification. So why is that? It's primarily useful when you don't have when you have a small amount of labeled training data for your classes, but large amounts of unlabeled data. And in a situation like that, what clustering can do is it can, cluster membership can actually reflect correlations between the attributes in your data that would be very difficult for the supervised method to learn with a small amount of training data. And that's really the reason why you would want to use something like that. So, and in the example that we'll talk about later today, we'll talk about how you can use clusters as a sort of completely different representation for items, where you take your instances, you cluster them, and then you throw away the original representation, and you just take the cluster memberships as the new attribute value vectors for your data instances. So, in this case, what you're assuming is you're assuming that everything that the classifier needs to classify at the end of the line will be reflected in the cluster memberships. All right, so the k-means algorithm itself, it's fairly simple. So what you get as input is a set of data points, x1 through xn, and you get k, and k is your guess as to how many populations you want to find. The way the algorithm works is it starts by positioning k centroids in the space completely randomly. So c1 through ck, each one of those is a vector over your attributes, the normal attribute value representation, just randomly initialized. And then you iteratively perform the following procedure. So you go over all the data points in your set. And for each data point, you figure out what cluster is, what centroid is it closest to. So if J represents a particular cluster, then you are finding a minimum of the distance between the point Xi and the centroid Cj of the Jth cluster. So there we have D. D represents our distance function. It can be a Euclidean distance, and that's a natural choice for many algorithms, but you can use any other distance function depending on what domain you're working with. So for some domains, Euclidean distance would actually be a really bad measure. You can plug anything you want in there. Right? So once you've done that, once you've computed the distances to all the cluster centers, you pick the cluster that is closest to you, pick the cluster with the smallest distance to the centroid, and you assign xj to that cluster. Right? You sort of say xj belongs to this particular, I guess this should be xi. Yeah. So Xi goes to cluster J. So this step partitions the data points into clusters. And then in the next step, what you're going to do is you're going to move the centroids around to better reflect the points that were assigned to them. And the way you do that is you iterate over all clusters. For each cluster, you're going to look at all the points that were assigned to that cluster, and you're going to recompute the centroid as the mean of the points that were assigned to it. Right? So you're going to throw away the old centroid, and you're going to take the average, the mean, the center of the points that went into that cluster. And that's going to be your new cluster center. And then you're going to repeat the procedure. Interesting question. Okay, so if you take the mean and your distance is Euclidean, then you can show that this actually minimizes the variance within the clusters. If your distance is non-Euclidean, then you can't actually show what you're minimizing. You can still, I think you can still take the mean. It might not be the optimal, but I don't see a reason why not. It just, it stops being interpretable. So if the distance is Euclidean, then it is interpretable in terms of variance. But if you use something else, then not. Okay, so, and you do this iteratively. Sorry, I forgot, yeah. You don't. So the question was, how do you determine how far to place the centroids from each other? In the classical k-means, you just initialize centroids randomly over your entire space. Right.
Okay. They would never be placed on top of one another.
Ooh, okay, all right. So if you place them on top of each other, then yes, you obviously have a you have a problem. Because the distance to two things will be identically the same. So, and in fact, if that does happen, they don't have to be placed on top of each other for that to happen. It can happen naturally. You do have to break a tie in some way. So, yes. Does it matter at what location you put them for the outcome? Yes, very much so. So, the k-means will produce different clusterings depending on how you initialized it. So it's a local minimum type of thing. So we'll talk about what to actually do about that. Okay, so you keep doing this iteratively until your stopping criterion. You stop when points stop changing clusters, right? So if you ever get to a point where if you ever get to a point where no instance moves from one cluster to another, then you know that you don't need to do any further updates because nothing is going to change. The centroids are not going to change. Everything depends on cluster membership. So that's sort of if you have a small amount of training, if you have a small amount of data or a lot of computational resources. In practice, on a big data set, you can realistically run k-means for a few iterations, and then you stop and sort of say, okay, I ran out of time. I'll take whatever it produced. Yes.
So if I understand correctly, even though you run until none of the cluster assignments change, because of the random placing of the centroids, running a clustering algorithm multiple times on the same data set may not necessarily produce the same clusters.
That is correct. So the question was, If you run the algorithm multiple times on the same data set, will it produce different clusterings? And the answer is yes. So it depends on how the initial random points fall into that space. And if you run it multiple times, you may very well end up with very different clusterings of the data.
Does it always converge?
Does it always converge? Yes, it does. Not to the in the sense that it will not oscillate. It converges to a local minimum. So it converges to a point that is stable, But that's not necessarily the best possible clustering. Okay, all right. So so that's when you stop. In general, the complexity of this is it has four components. So it's an iterative algorithm. So you have to factor in how many times you're going to iterate it over it. The number of clusters, k, because you're going to compare each data point to each one of those clusters. The number of instances, obviously, and then the number of dimensions, because each comparison, each distance computation is going to take this many operations, at least. All right. Oh, okay. I guess that's just the equation for the update of the mean. So Cj is the vector that represents the jth cluster. A is a particular attribute in your representation. And what you're doing is you're going over all the points that were assigned to cluster Cj and taking the value of that attribute that the ith instance had, just adding them up and dividing. Right. So obviously this only works for numeric attributes. You can't really, if you have categorical attributes, you can't do that. Okay, so let's look at an example. And this is just a toy example to illustrate how this works and why this even works at all. Because you might get a feeling that, okay, you're starting with random positions, so it's going to end up in some sort of a stable random position. That is true in a way, but this stable random position in a lot of cases will be pretty reasonable, right? So this is just a toy example to illustrate. So suppose I'm operating in a two-dimensional space. The white circles there are my data instances that I want to cluster. Each one of them has two attributes, the x and x1 and x2, or the x and the y. And I initialize the cluster means randomly like that, right? So that's not a very good initialization because I basically put them sort of in the same part of the space. It doesn't really reflect what you would visually think the clusters are. So let's see how it works. The first step is you take every instance and look at the distance from that instance to the yellow centroid and to the red centroid. I have two clusters, right? So if you do that and you color the instances according to which one they're closer to, you'll get something like this, right? So everything to the left of this line is closer to the yellow centroid. Everything to the right is closer to the red centroid. So this is my assignment. I've now assigned every instance to the cluster tentatively. Right. The next step is I have to move the centroids around. And the way I do that is I look at all the points that are colored yellow at the moment and compute the mean of them and do the same thing for the red points, just compute the center. So if you do that, these will be something like those will be the new positions of the cluster centroids. And that completes one iteration of the algorithm. So in the next iteration, I start with something like that, right? These are my new positions of the yellow and the red centroids. And I repeat the whole procedure. For each data point, I look at whether it's closer to the red or to the yellow. And in this case, these two points, they were, with the previous positioning, they were closer to the yellow centroid, but now they're actually closer to the red. So I need to change them. So they will change the membership, right? And now after they've changed the membership, I'm going to recompute the centroids by moving them to the center of the red points and the yellow points. Okay. So at the third iteration, this is going to be my situation. Those are my new centroids. And I at this point, again, I look at which points are misclassed or sort of which points have the wrong color. At this point, it was closer to yellow, but now it's actually closer to red. This point should become yellow. Change that. Those are the new cluster centroid positions. And I come to this point. And at this point, I notice that, okay, I've got my new centroids. But if I compute the distances, none of the points will want to change color. None of the points will want to move from one cluster to another. So at this point, I am done. Right? I've run a till convergence. It has converged to some configuration. And if you look at the final configuration, it's a little bit more sensible than what you started with. So even though you're starting with a random initialization of the centroids, in most cases, it will sort of navigate to a more useful partition of the data. Okay. So that was an example. Let's look at some properties. When you do k-means, you don't actually, you can understand the entire algorithm without even thinking of what it's trying to minimize. It's very simple. It's just iterative reassignment of points to clusters. If you try to analyze what it does, the algorithm tries to minimize this quantity. And what this quantity is, it's the sum of the squared distances from the centroid to each instance in the cluster of that centroid. So it's trying to minimize within cluster distances, or you can think of it as sort of within cluster radius in a way. That's what it's trying to minimize. So it's trying to put clusters in such positions that it will have as tight a group as possible around that centroid. If you're using Euclidean distance, then this quantity can actually be interpreted as the variance around the mean. It's a funny notion of variance. So if you imagine taking Euclidean distance, placing it for d, so it's the square root of the sum of the attributes of the distances between the centroid and the instance for that particular attribute. So the square cancels the square root. So you're going to end up with sort of three summations. And you can reinterpret it as a variance of each cluster where the centroid is treated as the mean, right? But it's a weighted variance. It's a variance that is weighted by the number of elements within a cluster, in a way. So if you have a cluster that has half of all the data points, it's going to have a big weight in the total aggregate variance. So that's one way you can interpret what it's doing if you're using Euclidean distance. If you're using something else, then obviously this interpretation doesn't hold anymore. But it still gives a useful intuition for what it's trying to do. So it's trying to produce these compact sets that are compact around the centroids as the mean. Okay. So as I already mentioned, it does converge to a local minimum. So what that means is if you run it multiple times, you will have different starting positions. You will end up with different clusterings. If that is disconcerting to you, and it should be if you have a small amount of data and large resources, then what you do is you repeat the algorithm several times, and you take the clustering that ends up having the smallest intra-cluster distance. Right. So you would use that as your function to tell you how good the result is. And why that? Because, well, if the distance is small, then the clusters must be tight. And if the distance in this clustering is smaller than this one, then in this one, it must have found better groups to put the centroids into. Okay. Again, you can, you should definitely do this if you have a small number of instances to work with. If you have a very large data set, you will be struggling to run the algorithm twice or three times. So you might not have the capability to do this at all. Another thing that is very bothersome about k-means, and this is something that's completely not obvious when you look at it. So it's trying to produce these tight groupings, right? That's what the cluster is all about. It's trying to move centroids into a tight group. But k-means doesn't actually guarantee that two nearby points are going to end up in the same cluster. Right. And if that seems counterintuitive, so here's an example where this is a centroid of one cluster, this is a centroid of another cluster, and this is a stable configuration. So if you tried to iterate over that, the cluster centroids wouldn't move. It's kind of counterintuitive, but because what you would want to do is you'd want one cluster to go here and another cluster to go here, because that would result in a much tighter clustering. But this is a stable point. If you ever get if the algorithm ever gets to a point like that, it will never get out, because sort of this point is closer to here than to here, and it would actually take quite a bit of moving to get out of this local minimum. So it's important to realize, even though it tries to make things as compact as possible, it doesn't guarantee that two nearby points will end up in the same cluster. When we talk about agglomerative clustering in a few lectures, agglomerative clustering does have that guarantee. So if two points are nearby, then they will end up in the same cluster. So that's one possible difference between the two. And if you think that this is actually a very unlikely scenario, then it's not really as unlikely as we might want it to be. When we as humans come up with intuitions about how something is going to work, we typically think in low dimensional spaces. So we think in 2D or 3D, and we think about points sort of densely distributed throughout space. Many of the data sets that you will be working with are completely the other way around. They're high dimensional, they're sparse, and what that means is that the data points, they don't actually live in the middle of the space. All of the data points live in the corners. And when you have a situation like that, most of the intuitions that you as a human have about what's likely and what's not likely is completely wrong. So the likely configurations are the ones that you don't actually think about. So things like that will happen more often than you want them to. Okay, so one annoying thing about k-means is you have to pick the number of clusters. So from the start, you have to say how many subpopulations you want. So how do you do that? Really, there is only one way. In some cases, you might have an intuition from just based on your domain for what the number of clusters should be. So if you're trying to cluster digits, you know how many subpopulations there are. There are only 10, right? If you're trying to cluster, if you're trying to recognize, photographs of 10 different dogs, then you know that there are only 10 dogs. So you would actually want to, you'd want to cluster with a value of 10. But if you don't have any hints from the domain, then one thing you can do is you could try to sweep over the different numbers of clusters, optimizing something. Right? And one thing we can optimize is we can try to optimize this distance, this measure of tightness, the aggregate intercluster distance. So what you would do is you would take your data set, you would run k-means with k equals to 2, you get a certain number of clustering, and here you compute what is the aggregate distance from the centroid of this cluster, the aggregate distance of the centroid of that cluster, right? And save that number, right? And then cluster into 3 sets, then cluster into 4 sets, cluster into 5 sets, and then pick whatever number of clusters gives you the best distance, the tightest distance. And if you try to do that, you will perhaps not surprisingly find that it doesn't do what you want. The smallest possible distance happens when k is the same as the number of data points in your training set. And why does that happen? That happens because when k is equal to n, each data point will get its own centroid, right? And the distance, k-means will faithfully optimize, and the distance between the data point and its cluster center is going to be 0, right? And in general, you can show that the bigger the number of points that you throw into k-means, the smaller the distance is going to be. So that is not very helpful, right? Breaking n instances into n subpopulations is not useful. We've seen this once before, right? So when you remember when we talked about the k nearest neighbors, we had a similar procedure for selecting k, and we also had a problem there that if you just do this on the training set, then It's maximized when you use one nearest neighbor. So that's a problem with using the same data for training the algorithm and then for finding a meta parameter. So one way we talked about solving this is by holding out a portion of the data as the validation set, right? And then perhaps doing the clustering on the training set and then taking this validation set and seeing, you know, without changing the centroids anymore, how would the points fall into it and what is the distance from the validation points to the cluster centroids. So you could imagine doing something like that. The problem is this doesn't actually help for k-means. And one of the reasons why it doesn't help is one way you can think about is you can think about your validation set as a set of points in space, right? And you're trying to cover that set of points with varying numbers of centroids. And just randomly, you would expect the more centroids you put in there, the closer each validation point would end up to one of those centroids. A mathematical reason why this happens is k-means, when it's computing distances, the measure of distance doesn't depend on the size of the cluster or the radius of the cluster. When we talk about EM in the next lecture, EM doesn't do distances. It tries to compute a probability. A probability is based on a Gaussian, and a Gaussian has a notion of variance. So there, the number of entries and how wide the cluster is will actually affect distances. Well, they won't be distances, they'll be likelihoods, but they're almost the same thing as distances for our purpose. So it will actually affect the distances. In this case, the distance is completely independent of how many elements there are in the cluster. So what will tend to happen is the more clusters you have, the higher the value of k, the better, the smaller the aggregate distance is going to be. So the better your objective function. So a validation set will not really help you pick the value of k. So one way that you could do this is if you actually plotted that distance function versus the number of clusters, you could try to look for a natural sort of the point that looks like a good stopping point. Right? So now we're going to see this thing again when we talk about principal component analysis. So and there it'll be a real plot of the variance versus the number of components. But for now, you can actually treat the aggregate distance as something reminiscent of the variance, right? And sort of try to look for a natural point where to stop. It'll keep going down the more clusters that you have, but you could try to visually pick out a point where it looks like a good stopping point, where sort of clustering further gives you only small decreases in the total variance. So it's hacky, but in many cases that's the best that you can do. So if you read Witten and Frank, they actually advocate minimum description length for selecting the value of k. Unfortunately, that is this is more of a it's more of a philosophical than a practical suggestion. So the minimum description length, what you're trying to do is you're trying to come up with an encoding for both the clusters themselves and for the distances between the points and the cluster centers where they belong to. And the problem is it all depends on how you pick the encoding. So unless you actually make it specific that this is how I'm going to encode the centroids and this is how I'm going to encode the distances, it's pretty useless unless you actually fix that. So I'm not actually aware of this being used. Okay, so let's start talking about one application of k-means. So and here what I'll try to do is I'll try to show how k-means as a technique have been used for trying to annotate images, and specifically how to represent images for a subsequent step of classification. So the goal there, the end goal is to label images based on what objects they contain. You can imagine sort of trying to classify images based on whether or not they contain particular type of scenery. But if you want to do that, the first step is to take your images and convert them into an attribute value representation. And the problem is, if you just take an image as a bitmap, the natural representation is pixels. Right? So for a typical photograph, you'll have thousands by thousands of pixels, and then you will have three different color channels, the R, the G, and the B, and each one of them is going to have 255 possible values. So if you try to use pixels as a representation, it's fairly large, so it's difficult to work with. It's also not very meaningful. So if your goal is to try to figure out that there is a tiger walking through water in this image, then a value of one pixel doesn't really allow you to draw that conclusion. What would be nice is if you had some way of mapping the bitmap into some sort of a semantic representation that told us something about how the image looks, what the different portions of the image look like. And the difficulty there, of course, is you want this representation to be reasonably insensitive to changes of position, right? So if my goal is to detect tigers doing a particular thing, then I don't actually know where in the image the tiger is going to be and where the other components are going to be. So I want some sort of a representation that is insensitive to position, but at the same time tells me something about how the image appears. So one approach that has been used is you take this image, you break it into a set of patches, so that's what the red grid represents there. You just slice it up uniformly. And then what you try to do is you try to come up with a description for each one of those patches. And how do you come up with a description? So ideally, I'd want to take that patch over there and say, that looks like grass. The problem is, to do that, I need a human. I need an annotator that would tell me that is a patch that looks grassy. So what I'm going to do instead is we're going to try to come up with a method that says this is a patch, and without saying in human words what it looks like, it's green and it's sort of stripy, it's textured like grass. We'll try to represent it using some sort of a label, and that label is going to be consistent across all the patches that are green and grass-like in some way. So that's the big idea for trying to use k-means for that. So you break the image into patches. The next step is you compute a set of visual features over that patch, and visual features could be things like hue. You know, is it primarily greenish or reddish or bluish? It could be things like texture. Is it smooth, like that patch over there? Or does it seem to be stripy, like that patch? Or does it have lots of corners? You could look at edge distribution. Are there edges? At what angles are the edges? So those are basic things that you often do in computer vision. Once you've done that, you get a real valued vector that represents the patch. And the challenge for learning is we have multiple patches in the image, right? And each one of them has a little feature vector. So all of the methods that we talked about, they require one feature vector for the entire image. So you could try to classify each patch independently, but that's not the same thing as classifying the entire image. So what we need to do is we need to figure out a way to go from these individual feature vectors into one big feature vector for the whole image. And you can't just concatenate them. Right? And the reason you cannot is that would impose a particular ordering. That would say that you can detect tigers only in a certain position. And as we said, one thing that you want out of this is you want to be able to detect no matter where the tiger is. You want a representation that's sort of insensitive to that. So the basic idea is you take these feature vectors, and then instead of trying to label them as something green and grassy, we will cluster them and then use a cluster label as a substitute for the feature vector. So the cluster label will be the same for all the patches that have similar visual appearance. And in effect, we'll be using it sort of like a word to describe a patch of a particular appearance, and then feed those words into a classifier for further classification. Okay. So I'll pick up here at the next lecture. This is flat. This is a hierarchy. This is flat. This is a hierarchy. So Keynes does that. Two clusters, you measure the distance, you get this number. Take three clusters, get this. Take four clusters, get this. There's no better way. It's not the only way, but there is no better way. There are other methods that don't work. I haven't actually talked about clustering yet. Yeah. It's just pre-processing. So what you're saying is, will you end up in the situation where there is a tie and you cannot break a tie? So you will not end up with the same number only if you cannot break ties.
No, I was asking if you have the same number of points to start with,
yes.
Clusters, and the same number will the cluster centers end up at all the points?
Not always, but if you run it multiple times, so if you sort of the minimum of that configuration is where there is a separate center for each data point. Yes. Yeah, there's really no way for it to oscillate.
Well, what all you do is you say at the end of every change in the assignment, the sum of the distances to all the centroids increases.
Yeah,
so it's strictly
smaller.
That's it. So it shows convergence. And it's bound to pull up.
It's actually kind of interesting, too. That question the guy asked, if you use a non-Euclidean distance.
Oh, so I think what you do is... Yeah, I was going to interject at the end. So... The idea is when you do the step, you think of it as alternating minimization, right? So when you reassign base and the centroids, you're minimizing the sum of all points of this. So the mean minimizes that for squared error.
Yeah, but for something else, you would actually. Yeah,
yeah. And there actually is an algorithm called k-medians, which where you pick the median instead of the mean.
Yeah.
And so then you're doing L1 instead of L2. So you could do any distance you want as long as you can minimize that distance with respect to the centroids.
Median.
Yeah, it's called k-medioids.
Okay.